www.ccradio.org.
This is a Camden Community Radio program for Refugee Week Radio. Different past, shared future. My name is Jason Manseray. Quite often when we think of refugees and asylum seekers, we overlook lesbian and gay people who have suffered violence and or sexual abuse in their home countries. I met a young man from Sri Lanka who discussed his incredible journey that eventually led him to the United Kingdom.
My name is Hari Shivananda Sharma and I come from Sri Lanka and I'm 22 years old. Yes, there was this soldier guy. I don't know how to describe it. I would say an intimate sexual affair now, looking back at it. But it wasn't just that. It was more of a friendship, I would say, but it had a sexual element in it.
How old were you?
I was 12.
How old was he?
I would say roughly about 20 to 25.
So does that mean that at that age, you know, you knew that you were gay?
I don't know, because that was my first sexual experiences, and in Sri Lanka we don't get taught about sex until we are 15, so I didn't know anything really about the sex part of it, but I thought it's something people do or something. I don't know what it felt, but I didn't like the sexual part of it. I disliked it, but I desired his company mostly because I was lonely and I didn't have a father, maybe.
When did you and other people start to identify you that you might be gay?
Well, I was aware of it when I hit the age of 13 in Jaffna, because in Jaffna you had access to magazines from Tamil Nadu and magazines from all over the place, really. Even we had a Reader's Digest and all these things. And I kind of started reading and then became aware of, you know, I started reading novels and stuff. So I kind of knew what went on there. So I didn't know the term for it. Because I didn't know the term gay until I was 16 or 17, but I kind of know, okay, yes, I am attracted to men. We faced bullying, but I had my own coping mechanisms, like staying too close to the teachers and pretending to read a book while the bullying goes on, or, you know, stay on the front bench instead of the back bench, or, you know, that sort of mechanism. And I became a teacher's pet, really, to escape the thing. And during intervals or playtimes, I don't go to the playground. I just go to the library, so that's a secure environment for me.
Did you find another outlet for, you know, your stresses, you know, that you were encountering?
Well, the first thing I did was writing the diary and sending it to a publisher in India and then commit suicide. That's what I was going to do, because it was an act of revenge. And that's what a poet did in early 90s in Sri Lanka. She just burnt herself to death after sending her poems to a friend. So I took that as an inspiration, and then I thought, okay, this is the only way to tarnish the whole society. but then I got saved.
And how did you get saved?
Well, my mother found out my letters and she rushed to emergency care, and I was put up in emergency care, and then they referred me to a psychiatrist help, and I got a social worker allocated for me, and then they advised me to change the school from Coquille Hindu College, which is the Hindu college, to non-religious school, which is Jaffna Central College, to do my A-levels. And that's where I had this access to public library, because the school was very near to the public library. The public library had internet access. Mm-hmm. Now, I got a computer because I got good results in O-level. So what I would do in the night time is writing stuff up at the house. And when I go to school, I will keep it in a floppy disk. And then after the school, I would rush to the library and try to post it on a Blogspot. I had a Blogger account. And then designing was nearly impossible. So I didn't really have any time to format the text. It was just bland text, unformatted text. But I sent it out to some people in the diaspora community, well-known writers and, you know, well-known individuals in the diaspora. I sent it the address to them via email, and then they got back to me saying, this is really, really important stuff, and it's really important that you're writing from the zone itself. And it was very supportive, and this way I can I can't deal with the revenge thing. Yeah, this is time to, publish really rebellious stuff. So I thought I fictionalized my encounter with the soldier guy. It was highly descriptive and homoerotic, deliberately beyond the limits of conventions, I suppose. And I published it online. And
it's a kind of a double life.
Yeah, double life, because on the online I had this identity, and in secret I was scared to death because it was a tough time. And I had this revenge to write bad things about everyone, like my teacher or the family or the religion, everything. I had this ridiculous urge to tarnish the values, I would say. But I couldn't do it in public, so I kept the diaries in secret. I started writing it, and then and I also was reading the novels and literary publications. So then when I hit 16, I kind of realized the literary value of it. So I started writing specifically about the schools I attended, and it was very confessional, like, based on very true events and true names.
Yep.
So people, I think somebody might have Googled their school name. I don't know how did get into the notice of, the people who are affiliated with my school or the Tamil Tigers. I don't know how it got their attention, but anyhow, it was the Tamil Tigers. Not the Tamil Tigers, because the Tamil Tigers are a very diverse organization. They have like affiliations with schools because they target schools as their main line of activity, because they didn't have any control over the Jaffna area. They had their base was in Vani, but they kept in contact with the schools in order to carry out activities like carrying out attacks on sentry points or distributing grenades, hand pistols and stuff. And they were very, very culturally orthodox. They tried to protect Tamil cultural values in order to stand up to the Sinhala oppression. So they thought cultural values are very important, and society has to stay orthodox in order to preserve the Tamil cultural identity. So any act of like this sexually explicit material would be considered as dangerous.
They found out?
They found out, and I received, it's like a three tier warning. They basically, if they find any dissident, they usually offer a first warning, which is kind and polite, please stop the activity. And the second one is very dangerous. It involves threatening you with a weapon. Like,
and what did you experience, one and two?
First, they asked me politely to remove all the blog posts and kindly apologize to them and admit in public that I always imagined, rather than, it's my fault, and they tried to, come up with a public apology from my side. But I refused it because I thought it's from the classmate of mine. I ignored it, and I thought, okay, I will stay silent, but I wouldn't take any, I wouldn't delete any.
Mm-hmm.
But then they visited me. We kind of knew they are coming to our house from the motorcycles, because the motorcycles are really loud. The motorcycles they use is deliberate.
You could hear this sound coming. It was like a warning.
Yes. So we kind of thought, okay, somebody in the neighborhood is in trouble. But it was us. So my mother didn't open the door. We were in the backyard pretending that nobody had set a home, and we switched off all the, any sound of the radios all off, and we didn't make a sound. So, but they were knocking. But then they came to the backyard to look for us. So eventually they were threatening to, okay, nangal veetta udaikka poram velila variya illa, this is okay, they were ready to break the house even to come into it, and they were using foul language as well. So my mother told me to wait in the room, and she locked the room, and she went out to meet them, saying that he's not here, he is staying at his cousin sister's house because he is studying for the exams. And they didn't believe her. They wanted to check all the house. There were three men. Then they found out the room was locked, and they asked her to open it. So that's how they found out. And
so what happened when they saw you?
Well, they had guns, and you know how they threaten you, and basically with a gun. And
so what, did they put it against your head, or did they just hold it up to you?
No, put it against my head, and yes, it was pretty humiliating, and my mother intervened, and they, you know, she fell on the floor and, you know, grabbed their legs and begging and crying, sobbing. It was, and she promised them that she will make sure that I stay silent and I issue a public apology online and, you know, delete the blog spot and stuff. And but then I didn't go to school. We basically got our social worker from the hospital to explain all the things to my school. After I said for my A-levels, my mother, the first thing my mother did was, during the time, the travel from Jaffna to Colombo was prohibited. We had to get security clearance to go into the capital city, and it was very hard to obtain a security clearance. So we had to pay 2 lakhs. 2 lakhs, which is 2 lakhs is
bribe or
bribe. We had to pay lots of money to get the security clearance from the army, but we had to go through a political party which is affiliated as paramilitary group. So yeah, we paid lots of money and got the clearance and went to live in Colombo. It was a newfound freedom for me, because if you go outside the Tamil community, you find all these you know, newly LGBT lobbying groups, and you know, they host pride festivals, and I attended one, and I got back home in a ridiculous costume, and it was the start of all problems, because they didn't like it, our neighbors didn't like it. It was very uncomfortable for us, and they scribbled some derogatory term on the wall, and
of your apartment,
of our apartment. And it wasn't...
What did it say?
Okay, basically they wrote this foul scribbling on my wall. It's saying, in Tamil, it's a cocksucker lives here. So I... my mother had problems with it, because she's a very, you know, cultured woman. She she likes to interact with the neighbors, but her son being like this wouldn't really... help her to interact with the new neighbors and stuff. And obviously it says that somebody in our neighborhood knew specifically who I am and what I am up to. So she thought, okay, let's move to some other place which where nobody cares. Actually, we were looking for our suburbs in Colombo, but that again is a problem because we are Tamils and we are from Jaffna. In our identity card it says we are Tamil, so it was hard for us to relocate anywhere in Colombo other than the Tamil area. But we found a neutral Muslim Sinhala area in it's called Colombo 15, and we moved to that area. And I was approached by the New York Times, because they became familiar with my online writings, and they wanted to do an interview about a recent Tamil immigrant from Jaffna, how he feels in Colombo as a Tamil. They wanted to get to know into the experiences, really. So they approached me, and I said, okay, I will do the interview. And it got published, and it got into the attention of a Tamil minister who is affiliated with the government. So it's kind of against the government and its policies and its practices against Tamil. So they visited us once. They kindly asked me to, you know, not to do this again. But
so they didn't hold guns up to you this time?
Not this time. But then again, I started an English blog after that. And I started writing about, you know, these things about Sinhala community, Tamil community, blah, blah, blah. And they didn't really like it. So, yeah, again, I got into trouble.
You got a second visit?
A second visit. But not with guns, but with threatening behavior. It was frightening enough, because we were living in Jaffna and we didn't really have any support network. In Jaffna, when it happened, we had a really...
So what happened to you then?
Well, even this time, my mother intervened and said, oh, he is my only son, please, he is the one all I have for my entire life. I was unaware of the serious situation, because, you know, I was only 19. And even though I was facing persecution, I had support networks from the LGBT group and, you know, that sort of support networks. But I didn't realize that I am in danger, because I was oblivious to these things. But my mother made an arrangement to go to, come to United Kingdom. She contacted my cousin who lives here, and she borrowed money to get me a student visa, and then that's how I got here. When I came to London, I went to live with my cousin sister. She is It was shocking for me because I wasn't expecting this at all. I thought they will be integrated into United Kingdom. They will be as, you know, liberals, you know, okay with my attitude and stuff. But they were more orthodox than the ones anyone I have ever seen in Sri Lanka. Really, they were more orthodox. And she ordered me. Really, that's how it was. She ordered me to cut my hair down, and. Cut it down and, you know, behave in a more of an acceptable way like any man of my age does. And she wanted me to...
You know, to have the same restrictions and lack of freedom in a free country that you had.
Yeah.
So what happened then? I mean, did you continue to live with her or no?
I lived there for 2 months because normally I didn't have any options to go.
Harry ended up being homeless for 3 months and relied heavily on the support of his university friends. Eventually, though, with their help, he was granted asylum. However, it was a struggle to get status based on sexuality alone. Peter Tatchell is a prolific political, lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender or LGBT campaigner. I spoke with him to hear his views on LGBT refugees and asylum seekers and what he calls their abuse by the Home Office.
Peter, when most people think of refugees coming to the country, they think of ethnic minorities or political beliefs or maybe religions being persecuted in their own countries. But there's other minorities as well.
That's right. Lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people suffer great persecution around the world. Nearly half the countries on this planet still criminalise same-sex relations, with penalties ranging from a few years' imprisonment right up to life imprisonment in countries like Uganda and Bangladesh. And in several Islamic states, there is actually the death penalty for same-sex relations. In addition to the legal persecution, there is the persecution from communities, families, and vigilantes. Time and time again, in asylum hearings involving Sri Lankan lesbian and gay refugees, I've heard Home Office barristers and asylum adjudicators not understanding the complexities and real on-the-ground dangers that people face on the grounds of their sexuality or their gender identity.
In what way?
Well, one issue is the law, which is pretty straightforward. But the second issue is about how the law is interpreted and enforced. And the third issue is the informal community pressure, family pressure, religious pressure that is exercised on LGBT people in Sri Lanka. In particular, there are parts of the Muslim community in Sri Lanka which are very, very deeply fundamentalist, very, very heavily influenced by extreme fundamentalist ideas. And in those communities, gay people are at serious risk of being murdered by their families or communities in so-called honour killings. This is not something that the Home Office and the asylum system adequately addresses and recognises. Even today, there is no International Human Rights Convention that explicitly and specifically protects lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people against discrimination. And when we look at the Refugee Convention, which governs the rights and responsibilities vis-a-vis refugees fleeing persecution, it lists many grounds but does not explicitly or specifically cite sexual orientation or gender identity as a grounds for refuge. What has happened in Britain in recent years is the Refugee Convention has begun to be interpreted to protect lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people against discrimination and persecution. But that's an interpretation.
So not only are you looking out for LGBT rights around the world, perhaps in the UK as well, you're looking for a change in legislation.
Absolutely. Asylum adjudicators and Home Office asylum barristers now mostly receive education and training in race and ethnic awareness issues, and also in gender awareness issues, but not in issues around sexual orientation and gender identity. So some of them still have quite stereotyped views. I mean, I've heard an asylum adjudicator say to a very masculine, straight-acting man that he doesn't look gay, and casting doubt and credibility on his gayness and his persecution on the grounds of homosexuality. I've also heard an asylum adjudicator say to a woman who's been married with children that this is proof that she can't be a lesbian, completely ignoring the family, religious and cultural community pressures that force many lesbian women into marriages in countries where there is no queer social space, where LGBT people don't have any independence from their families or communities. And I know from my own experience of dealing with lesbian and gay asylum seekers from Sri Lanka that the complexities of the situation there are not well understood or acknowledged either by the Home Office, the Border Agency, asylum adjudicators, or Home Office barristers. They don't understand the kinds of pressures that exist, the kinds of persecutions that exist. They just look at the formality of the legal code and ignore the reality on the ground where a combination of nationalistic, sectarian, religious groups, despite whatever the law may say, actively persecute lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender Sri Lankans.
Refugees who end up in the UK have often gone through some of the most traumatizing experiences life can offer. The process of healing from that is an extraordinary one, and conventional therapy is sometimes not enough. The Right to Life project was established 11 years ago. It uses creative writing to help asylum seekers work through their past and negotiate their futures. Poems and stories from Right to Life are being performed at All Hallows Church on Savernake Road on Saturday, June the 25th. They'll be introduced by the actress Juliet Stevenson and the filmmaker and writer Sheila Heyman, who runs the project. Harriet Bird went to meet Sheila to find out how writing has the power to combat alienation and pain. Sheila started by explaining how the project works.
The Right to Life project is a therapeutic creative writing project that's based in the Medical Foundation in Finsbury Park, and it's been running for about 11 years, and I've been lucky enough to run it for about the last 7 years of those, and it is, I think, the only group of its kind in the world that does therapeutic writing with survivors of torture. Because we've been funded continuously to run for all this time, it's become this extraordinary sort of almost like a family, because, well, you know, it has lots of different purposes, but one of them is rebuilding trust. Our clients all come from different parts of the world, and they've all had sort of different experiences in detail, but broadly they've all basically had their trust completely abused and been treated in horrible ways. And so when they come, they're often very isolated, and by a sort of cruel irony, the people they're least able to trust are the people from their own communities, often because they might be government spies, or they might be from an opposing faction, or they might be from the government that, you know, killed their father. So they come to our group, and because it's a group where you don't have to interact directly with the other people, I mean, they sit together and they write and then they read out their work, but they don't have to, but you're sitting in a community of people sort of, and you can wait for as long as you like before you actually, you know, you can join in with it at your own pace. And so it becomes a safe space where they are with people whom they don't know, but they can trust, and who have had similar experiences to theirs, which they are sharing. And so we always start with a little meal because, well, that's sort of significant in itself, because some of them travel for an hour and a half in each direction to get to us, which is really extraordinary to me. You know, why would you do that just to sit, you know, with a bunch of other people in a rather ugly room for 2 hours every other Wednesday night? And clearly there is something incredibly important to them about what goes on in that room. So we give them a kind of a very simple meal beforehand so that they'll have something to eat, you know, for the long trek home afterwards. And that's a time when people can share their news and catch up with each other. And so it's all kind of rather jolly. And then we do the workshop. And then in between the workshops, they have an opportunity to do a kind of one-to-one session. So the workshops on the whole are the place where we tend to sort of celebrate the joy of writing, you know, that there is this sort of wonderful place that you can go to, that you can't be evicted or deported from, that you can go to at any point, you know, that you can invent, that you can make in any way that you want it to make. The pleasure of creating and the pleasure of putting things into words. And so it's sort of, we tend to have quite a lot of variety in the workshops and you know, in the way that they are and what they're about. And then in between, they have an opportunity of working with a professional writer as a one-to-one mentor. And that's the time on the whole when they tend to you know, explore the more painful bits of their past and go back over that and make sense of it. And I sort of always try and say it's a bit like living in a haunted house. You know, if dreadful things have happened to you, it's like being in a haunted house in the sense that the ghosts will never go away. The ghosts are in the fabric of the wall of the house in the same way as they're in the fabric of your psyche. But the power that they have is only the power that you allow them to have. You know, they don't have any power except the power that you give them. And so if you can take those experiences and you can put them out on the page instead of having them run around in your head day and night, and if you can say to them, you belong in the past, you're only a story, you're not real, then in a sense you take back the power. And so that process of sort of objectifying their stories and their experiences is a really important part of their therapeutic recovery, I think. And that's what they tend to do initially, at least in the one-to-one work. And then, of course, you know, we try to move them into sort of writing about other things and, you know, moving on. I mean, and a lot of them also want to write about the appallingness of, I mean, in a sense, they've escaped from one kind of hell to come to another, because the institutionalized sadism of the asylum system is such that many of them feel that they're suffering almost worse now than they were then, because there's no end to it. You know, if you're a refused asylum seeker with waiting to have your appeal heard, you can be 7 or 8 or 9 years, and every single day you don't know whether it's the day when you're going to be sent back to the place that you risked everything to escape from. And you can never put down roots, and you can never make commitments, and you can never make friends, because you don't know how long you're going to be here, and they don't let you work, and you have no money. So a lot of them want to write about that as well. So, you know, but then, you know, some of them just want to write. Some of them are really artists and are naturally gifted writers, and they want to write about all the things that writers write about. So it's a lot of writing.
Yeah, to what extent is it, is the aim to produce something that stands up in a literary sense, and in what sense is it to work through the process and to kind of uncover those demons?
Well, it's I suppose it starts off for all of them as a therapeutic process, but, you know, as I said, they're all very different. Some of them have been writers when, you know, in the places that they came from, and that's actually the reason why they end up with us in the first place, which is a kind of testimony to the power of writing, that it can frighten governments so much that they try to kill people to stop them doing it. But some of them just have never written before and just discover it when they come. So some of them write at a sort of fairly basic level, and it is just a processing thing. And some of them are really gifted and want to write stuff that does, as you say, stand up on its own merits in a literary sense. And you just, you know, they all write at different levels in their own ways.
And what has it, do you think, taught you about the experience of being a refugee here in the UK?
When I was little, my parents rather foolishly bought a rather large house just at the point when my sisters were about to leave home. And because in those days it was actually legal to discriminate against people on the grounds of race, there were lots of foreign students who couldn't find anywhere to live, and my father was a mathematician professor. So they filled the house with, well, it sounds rather romantic, they had lodgers from all over the place. And so my father's colleagues were from all over the place as well, because he's a mathematician. And so I got used as a child to having people from, you know, Africa and China and Japan and Louisiana and all kinds of weird places sort of in the house. And I think I sort of feel as though I've come back to that. I think it's a fantastic thing to be part of a genuinely international community where people come together because of something that, you know, they have in common, and they discover that they have much more in common as people than they do separating them as cultures. It's, you know, what it's taught to me about the refugee experience is that it's a complete scandal. It is absolutely horrendous, and that, you know, obviously compared to a lot of other people, we are relatively tolerant and relatively welcoming. And I don't think that most people actually do hate refugees and asylum seekers. I think the trouble is that the government, successive governments, have found it in their interest to demonise this very tiny and very vulnerable group of people who've got nobody to speak up for them, because it's a very useful way of deflecting public anger from other things. And if you look at the figures, it's like, I don't know, 25,000 people a year, tiny number of people who are asylum seekers, and yet they have become the focus for all this kind of resentment and hatred, which is stirred up by almost all the media in a very unpleasant way.
And what power do you think the writing that they produce has to challenge that?
I think it has enormous power. I think it's really interesting sort of going You know, because we go to quite a lot of festivals and we do other kinds of things, and it's always such a struggle to get an audience for performances of our work without, you know, because you know what, you know, people feel they have to pull a long face when you tell them what you do, and they think, oh, that's terribly worthy, and gosh, you must be such a noble person, and so they turn up to these things out of a sort of sense of duty, you know, very much a sense, the same sense of duty with which they might read, you know, The Guardian rather than Hello, and then they discover that actually, you know, these are fantastically charismatic and interesting and vibrant people. Of course they have to be, because they've survived so much and still come through, and that their work is interesting, and that they're beautifully dressed, and that they're very elegant, and that they have huge amounts of dignity and self-respect, and their attitude completely changes, and that happens over and over and over again. And I just think anybody who has that kind of prejudice, it's just because they haven't ever actually met an asylum seeker. And I think that, you know, the thing about being able to write is that it's a multiplier, isn't it? You know, if you just meet somebody and talk to them, then that's only one encounter. But if you can write something and have it published, or write something and have it performed, then dozens or hundreds of people can get to know what it's like from your point of view and get to know you as a person.
Do you think there's any danger in constantly reiterating the fact that these people are refugees and asylum seekers rather than something else?
Well, I mean, I think that's the situation in which they've been placed. It's their reality. I mean, I don't think that they want to be labelled as that in the general context of their lives, but, I mean, that is, you know, who they are, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm. And when you're working with them, how detached do you stay from their experiences and their stories, or do you at all?
It's not so much the stuff that happened in the past, because there's nothing that one can do about that. You know, it can be very painful and horrific to hear about it, and it can be very painful to go, you know, the part of the process is, sorry, this is a sort of different point, but I'll make it anyway. Part of the process and the bit that's actually helpful psychologically is not just writing down what happened, but sort of going back over it. Because mostly, you know, what tends to happen with PTSD or any kind of trauma is that you might remember the facts, but you suppress the emotions. And so we have to go back. So they write a very factual, bleak account of what happened, and then we have to go back with them and fill in, you know, find ways of making them fill in the emotions. And that's a sort of re-experiencing, which can be very unpleasant. But, I mean, so that's the sort of, in a sense, that's the professional part of the job, and it's interesting and it's painful, but it's intriguing and it's fascinating. I think the thing that I find hardest is trying to help them in the here and now. You know, when they come to you and they say, I'm going to be deported, or I've got no money to buy, you know, food because I've got to buy my thesis, so I haven't eaten for 4 days, or, you know, my wife's been told she's got to go away, or I'm living in a house where my neighbours are crackheads and I can't ever get any sleep. You know, they come to you endlessly, you know, not surprisingly, because I'm the person that they know, wanting things and needing things that I can't give them. And that is quite difficult, but I guess I'm lucky in one sense, in this, as much as my husband, although he's very supportive, is not sort of at all interested or willing to let me bring it home, and so I can't actually, you know, there's a sort of a boundary that's imposed by that, you know, I can't bring them into my house or, you know, give them all my clothes or any of those kinds of things, because really, in a way, you know, I think this is an experience everybody has who works with people who are needy and vulnerable, that it's endless. You know, you can never help people as much as you would like to. And so I just do what I can, really, and that's it.
And tell me a bit about Survivor next week.
Right, well, this is an event that has been organised by an extraordinary woman called Rachel Douglas, whom I've never met, but who's clearly some kind of a sort of tornado in human form. And she's got an extraordinary group of, she's got singers and choirs and musicians and actors and performers and all sorts of other people, and brought them together to celebrate the work of the Medical Foundation, and it's sort of centred around the work of my group, which is I'm incredibly gratified and pleased by. And one of the really sort of thrilling things that has happened, and actually only happened yesterday, is that they wanted to set a piece of our writing to new music. They wanted to have a music specially composed, and the piece amongst the selection that I sent them that they picked out, unfortunately, had been written by somebody who had completely vanished from the group about a year and a half ago, and none of our attempts to contact her had come to anything. She's a marvellous Somali woman who makes her whole life into a sort of party, but she's very, very volatile. So if everything, you know, if it's not wonderful, it's terrible, because she, basically, her life was blown apart at the age of 10, and so she's remained emotionally, you know, rather at the age of a 10-year-old. Anyway, she's an extraordinary character, but she just vanished and none of us could get hold of her. And we were really sad about this. And then suddenly, the day before yesterday, I got an email saying that she had randomly phoned up the woman who's coordinating the group at the moment and had reappeared. So she's going to be there, which is just absolutely marvellous. She's going to be there to see her little poem, you know, turned into a piece of music. And that goes back, in a sense, to what you were talking about earlier about the levels of sophistication. She is somebody who has very, very limited English. You know, she doesn't really speak very good English and she has a very strong accent. But sometimes that's a kind of crucible that can really distill the meaning of emotion. And if you only have a very few words, you use those words in a really kind of potent way. And so this poem that she's written is very simple and not at all sophisticated in any literary sense. But clearly there was something in it that sufficiently touched the composer that was the thing that he wanted to set. And so she's going to be there to hear it, which will be really nice.
When a local refugee group recently celebrated 15 years of work in Camden, Camden Community Radio was there too.
That was the voice of a young Somali woman singing verses from the Quran at the opening of a celebration of 15 years of the British Somali community, a Camden group which was set up and has been led by women since the mid-1990s. The singing of Quranic verses in public by women is a little unusual. The singing at this event illustrates the unique way in which the British Somali community has been empowering the next generation with knowledge and expertise that they may need to look their future in the face and make informed decisions about how they wish to change and what aspects of their heritage they may choose to keep. Since the mid-1990s, BSC has run a weekend school for Somali children in Camden. At its height, 160 boys and girls spent 6 hours of activities organised to help them bridge the gap between their former lives in Somalia and the lives they hoped to live in London. We were welcomed by the British Somali Community Coordinator, Khadija Shire.
Welcome, I'm pleased to see everyone valuing our 15th anniversary for women and girls. We work with the young people, families, children, elderly people, young youth, but only few can be illustrated, including film of Generation Gap, FGM, which is an innovative project in Camden we started a year ago.
One of the many guests at the celebration was Dame Jane Roberts, former leader of Camden Council.
Enormous admiration and respect for the organisation and the work that's done. It's not always very visible to the outside world, but it's absolutely crucial to the women and the families and the children that you work with and has been, because you're now 16 years old. I just wanted to say a word about women and mothers before I get on to the stars of the show, which are the girls. Because it's women and mothers that drive the world round, really, isn't it? I'm sorry to you guys, but actually that's the truth, isn't it? It is women and mothers that power the world. I just want to pay tribute to that, because often the stage is taken by men, but the work is done by the women. Really important work is done by the women. And for some of the Somali mothers here, you can speak much, much more than I can of the huge changes that there have been in your life and the importance of education. My understanding is the education system in Somalia pre-1990 was thriving, was flourishing, was intact, and actually terrible things happened in the Civil War, and that fell apart. You had to cope with all of that, the trauma, the violence of that, to come over to this country, the dislocation that involves, all the changes that there are, and somehow to make sense of that, keep your family together, push things on. It's just such a remarkable achievement, and I do want to pay tribute to you. But the girls, can I just say a big, big well done to the girls, because you're the stars of the show. You're on the stage, quite rightly. You pushed the boys out for tonight, and quite rightly.
As well as food to die for, there was a short play about attitudes in education, a presentation about the campaign against female genital mutilation, and a fashion show, all presented by the next generation of young Somali women. Another founder member, Ashakin Duale, told us how the British Somali community got started.
First of all, I'm here to talk about the role of Somali women and also to talk the history and background of British Somali community. You just know that we exist only 15 years, but how we came to be is a very good story to me. I think this really started somewhere in Camden when we identified as women what were our needs as women. We didn't know the language. We were refugees. Most of us were single mother. We came in an alien country. Even the environment, the weather was killing us. Everything was great. Back home we had light, 12 hours sun. We got colorful dresses. Everything was black and gray. So what we did, we got together. And the first meeting we had was sometimes in 1995. Why we set up British Somali community? The need was overwhelming as Somali women. So we selected only two topics. And after 15 years, we stick with these two topics, which is education for our children and women, and health, access to health. These are the two things, because we have issues with immigration, with housing, with all sorts of, but we stick with these two. The need for a Somali woman as a refugee was big, simply because we got four denominations we never had back home. We were refugee, black, woman, and Muslim. And we still stick with these four. We have a problem accessing services because of language. But then we discovered we were leaving out the young girls. So that's why we are focusing now. In the past 10 years, we're focusing with the young girls. We never believed that we are being discriminated because we're black or Muslim or women. Simply because if you don't push yourself, you don't ask, yeah, you cannot say, I've been discriminated. So what we learn is ask, knock the door, because this is what you need. We got more than 21 volunteers. 21 volunteers. And believe me, apart from the session of teachers, these 21 volunteers are this only 1 year. Because every year, the girls who volunteer in our office, they get a job. And we got examples that I can't cite. We got partners. We should thank the local authority for helping us to stand on our feet. Although now we are very, very much in the bull's eye because of the cuttings. After 15 years, we don't want to be on our knee. Then we have the police. We got the Somali organization, our partners. We got other black ethnic minority as partners. We got like Hopscotch or the Asian. We got Comic Relief and Lions and Volunteer. And I would like also to thank. Have we got men in our structure? None in the decision table. None. Simply because we believe that it is our space. And our space should be it. It's our needs and we should deal with them by ourselves. But we got some volunteer men I would like to thank. I think I might explain it. What we selected was supplementary school, outings. We did outings all the way to Brighton, Margate, Southend. We have never been there, no one of us. But we went with 3-4 buses together with the kids and their mothers. Health access to Dr. Esfahani Haji, a gynecologist who dealt with our particular health issues, which you have seen the FGM. We got girls' activity, sport, we got the reproductive health project, which I believe a man was involved. We got all women sessions. We got also for 3 years a volunteering project, which was wonderful. The staff, we just got one person, and that is Khadija Shire. Without her, I don't believe British Somali community would have strived. I would like you to ask, what next? The what next is not me as co-founder or trust to talk, but it's for you young Somali girls to help British Somali community to pave the way for the second generation of Somali women. And that's I conclude. Have a nice night.
Among the young adults who came to pay tribute to those who set up and those who continue to run the British Somali community were a busy young professional, a newly trained teacher, and Camden's first elected Somali councillor.
I wasn't actually meant to be coming today because I had so much work in the office. I thought to myself, I can miss a lot of things in life, but I can't miss this event. and I used to be one of the services of this organisation, and I remember waking up on a Saturday very excited to go to the supplementary schools, and it's happening every Saturdays and Sundays, and there were hundreds of kids, hundreds of young people who are now grown men, grown women, who play an active role within the society. And I would like to take this opportunity to thank the Smart Community and also the funders who supported him doing so. I speak for London Somali Forum, and we are based all across London. The Somali community is very fragmented. Even within Camden, if you tell me how many Somali communities are in Syndex, I'm sure you'll be confused. But if you were to tell me who are the most affected, the Somali community would be amongst most affected organisations. And I hope it continues for a long time. And I'm very proud to stand here and say I am actually a product of the British Somali community. I'd like to take the opportunity to actually thank Howard Khadija and Howard Ashikin. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all the mothers and every person who's made a big impact in changing our community.
I went to university, graduated in December. I'm training to be a secondary school teacher. From the age of 18, I was a volunteer with the British Somali community. I then went on to work with the Peer Sexual Health Education Project. And during university, I was a volunteer, and I could put that on my CV, so it always looked good, and it helped me get to where I am right now.
I'm the first counsellor of Somali origin in Camden. I'm one of five Somali councillors in London. Encourage a lot more Somali people to stand for election and fight for their local communities, especially, when I say this, especially the girls, because we don't have one single Somali councillor who's a woman. Please do stand, please do become politically active, and please do represent your local communities. I was actually, and you can see I'm not a girl, but I was one of the people who actually used the supplementary schools growing up about 14 years ago, which makes me feel really old now. So I actually went to supplementary schools for 5 years. Supplementary schools are incredibly important to me because it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot more than the comprehensive schools, the grammar schools, the state schools, all around Camden, all around London. It taught me a lot more. It taught me integration. It taught me respect. It taught me how to engage with family, how to engage with friends. It taught me a lot more than a normal school would have taught me. And it was incredibly important to me because it enhanced the richness of my culture. And that's why I thought supplementary schools, especially the British Somali Community Supplementary School that I went to. And let me just say a couple of things about Eda Ashikin and Eda Khajija. If you don't know what Eda means, it means auntie. You don't want to mess with them, but they are very fair, and they're very, very good people. And anytime I ever wanted advice, anytime I ever wanted support, they were always there to give it to me. And they were always there to help me, and they never, ever, they're not people who will ever let you down. And that's why this organisation has managed to work so well for so many years.
I think it was really nice, and I love seeing them really, really scared. But then they gained confidence, and I was so proud.
And everybody was having so much fun. It was far too noisy to talk to anybody else. But everybody seemed agreed that Khadija Shearer and Asha Kinduale and all of the women at the British Somali community have been doing a splendid job. This is Marion Larrigy, and you're listening to Camden Unlocked for Refugee Week Radio.
Movement for Justice is fighting for a future where all people are treated equally. A world where we can all express our culture and identities. This is a civil rights organisation. These are the passionate and moving stories from some of their members.
My name's Antonia Bright. I'm one of the leaders in Movement for Justice by Any Means Necessary, which is a civil rights organisation working to build a independent, integrated, youth-led mass civil rights movement, speak the truth about racism, fight for immigrant rights, and fight for LGBT equality, fight against sexism, all of the things that are progressive. We actually started back in 1995, and that was around that kind of anti-immigration legislation that was being brought in at the time, and also a realisation for us that it was going to take building a movement at a time where there were so many racist attacks, deaths in custody, as well as the anti-immigrant stuff. we were watching campaign after campaign be just running around in the system, not getting anywhere, not getting justice, being shut down in a whole variety of ways. And we knew that it was going to take building a movement that is speaking the truth about racism and that's independent of the political parties and their own agendas, but can make demands on them if we're going to be able to really change the society or get the Britain to live up to the kind of promise as an integrated multicultural society that it is, live up to the kind of promise of equality that exists.
Now, of course, it's Refugee Week, so human rights is a big issue. Now, that's a large area that your organisation focuses on.
Yeah, and the Movement for Justice is a group that is incredibly integrated. A lot of our members are asylum seekers or refugees who have been through the detention system, been through all the contradictions and racisms in the UK system, as well as, you know, as well as British-born people. We're a mixed group, but everyone is a leader, and everyone is in the group because they're fighting for themselves, their rights, and for each other's.
Now, previously you mentioned race quite a lot, and obviously when you're talking about people coming or fleeing a country, mm-hmm. You know, seeking asylum, it's because they've been persecuted possibly for their ethnicity or their religious beliefs and so forth. But there's another very big issue that people forget about when it comes to seeking asylum.
Yeah, it's still true that I think more the proportions of if you're gay or lesbian, transgender, the number of people who are being fast-tracked or deported to countries knowing that in those countries it's illegal to be gay.
Does the Home Office recognise LGBT?
To be quite honest, no, because one of our members right now is held in Harmansworth, who is a gay man from Tanzania. Now, he's been told, along with lots of people, well, we don't believe you're gay. And since the Supreme Court decision last year declared that Britain could not send people, knowing that they're gay, back to countries where they'd be persecuted, that Britain could not any longer say, pretend you're not gay and go back and you'll be safe, you'll get on fine, you don't look too gay, so just go and be discreet. It's what they used to say. Now, what they say is, we don't believe you're gay. And in this way, they can circumvent the Supreme Court decision.
Well, I guess this is very difficult. How do you prove that someone is gay?
It's kind of a ridiculous task to us because being gay is something you are. It's your identity and it's something that you declare. It's not something someone looks at you and say, well, you look gay, you don't look gay, this one's gay, this one's not. Because if you're making that decision, you're kind of, you are going to make mistakes. You're going to send people to their deaths, potentially.
Really? It's very difficult. So I guess the big question here is, what are the demands? What are you guys looking for?
Well, one thing is we're saying, like, that this system, this asylum system, is insane. And it's more of a lottery than a searching of the truth. And so all of the detention, the fast-tracking, it has to end. We should be saying as a country that we should be doing an amnesty for all immigrants and asylum seekers.
My name is Serigne Tako. I'm from Senegal. I'm 24 years old. I've been in UK for 3 years now. Came in UK in December 2008.
And what was the main motivation for you coming to the UK?
I'm Senegalese and it's a Muslim country. I'm a homosexual. I start to know my sexuality when I was 13 years old, and it's the reason why my father was sending me to one village outside Dakar, outside Casamance, the village called Tubamba Bari. The reason why I was there because my father knew I'm a homosexual, and he asked me. I told him as well. So he told me, you're gonna go there. Then I escaped, come back Dakar. My mom helped me to speak to my dad till he let me stay. And few months or years later, the way I was developing, and I started have my first relationship in there. That was when I was 16 years old, and my dad started to see me the way I was developing, and he said he will send me again. And it's why he sent me to the Senegal capital, Dakar, is Senegal, capital of Senegal. And I went there to do me for a course, welding course, to tell me to do a main job. My father was a politician as well, and during that those experiences, the president my dad was following, he lost his election in 2000, and my father cannot afford to pay the rebels anymore the money he used to pay them to his family, for his family being saved. And my father tried to escape to come to Dakar, where I am. During the, when he was coming, and he used a ferry, that ferry, they have an accident. It's the reason why my family was dying in that accident. And after that, a few weeks later, my auntie called me, and she's the one who told me my father is dead. And I couldn't pay the course in welder anymore, and the room I was sleeping, so I need to leave the welding course. And what happened is my auntie let me stay on her house, and I have a group of women. They call them, it's like one group of women, they're having party house to the another, and for my local community. And I used to go there having dance with the girls, and the community know I'm no interested in to have a sex with the girls, and they call me as a chair boy. And it's how my auntie start to know that I'm homosexual. They asked me, I told her the truth, and she told me, you cannot live any more longer in the house, so I have to leave. And it's why I stopped and end up on the street. And after a few weeks later, I find a job working as a prostitute in the poor in Dakar to find something to help myself do it, because no one want me near their families. And how I start to work there, and people start to know, people from that area start to know I'm having a sex with the men in that area. So
Was it very dangerous?
It was very dangerous. And the group, they have been attacked there twice. First time I have been stabbed on my leg with my foot. And I managed to escape, run away. And it's the second time, the same thing. They was about to kill me, and someone who hold my both hands on my back, they put it on my back and cross a big knife to my then I move, then the knife it crossed to my chest. I have a big scar here. Then I managed to escape again. After that, I was too afraid with my life. And what happened is I talked to one of the my client who was very close friend with me, who working at the port, and she asked me what happened. I told him everything. And he said he will try to help me to leave Senegal. And he told me he will go to Spain. But that time, I don't speak Spanish. I don't know nothing about Spain. I don't have no friend in there. And what happened, I accepted. And he said, you cannot take a boat in this port. You need to go to a different place because you might find people who know you. It's what I did, go to different area to take a boat, fishing boat, open boat, to get to Canary Island. And from there, I've been helped from the Spanish authority, helped me to get to Spain. And in Spain, for the first time, was okay, because one of the Senegalese friend I met to the camp when he was in Canary, helped me to find his cousin in Spain. They knew that I'm homosexual as well. One of the Spanish lady mentioned that to the guy I used to live with. And because she doesn't think that's his problem or something. Then the guy called me and asked me if it's that true. Then I said yes. So the guy was a bit surprised why I don't tell him. But he spoke to me nicely, and he said, I cannot leave this house any more longer. Then after that, I need to leave again to that house. So the friend who gave me that guy contact, he lived in, that time he was in Barcelona. And I have another friend who live in Valencia. So I got his contact and I went to Valencia, and life was very dangerous there for me. And I met some Senegalese who used to threaten me. So it's how I tried to escape from Spain to come in the UK.